Hello, everyone, and welcome to Culturally Relevant, a podcast about film, television, art, and culture. I'm David Chen, and today let's talk about something a little bit less consequential than we usually do on this podcast. Let's talk about some Star Wars, specifically Star Wars Episode 9 and the accompanying making of documentary The Skywalker Legacy. Now, I'm one of the people that was pretty disappointed by Star Wars Episode 9 when it was released into theaters this past December. I thought it was a pretty rough movie overall. It felt really jumbled and rushed, and none of the decisions felt like they meant anything. And I also thought it was a pretty bad conclusion to the 9-film Skywalker saga. But I had heard that this documentary, The Skywalker Legacy, which is available right now on Disney Plus, and if you buy the video-on-demand version of Episode 9, I'd heard the documentary was pretty great. And so I wanted to take this opportunity to watch the documentary and also talk about it with someone who knows a thing or two about Star Wars. My guest today is Patrick H. Willems. His videos on YouTube have been viewed tens of millions of times. He makes a lot of great video essays about filmmakers, about Star Wars, about all kinds of things that I'm interested in, and I really enjoy talking with him about movies. I've actually done a few videos with him about his videos. I do some commentary videos with Patrick on his second channel, Patrick H. Willems Presents. I'll link to everything in the show notes. But I was really grateful that Patrick had a chance to watch Skywalker Legacy and decided to talk with me about it. We also talked about The Last Jedi, which is Episode 8, as well as the accompanying documentary for that movie entitled The Director and the Jedi. So we'll spoil everything in these Skywalker movies. You should know that going into the podcast episode. But I do want to mention that you can find a video version of this conversation on my YouTube channel. You can subscribe to my YouTube channel to get updates as they arise. So without further ado, here is my conversation with Patrick Willems about The Skywalker Legacy.
It's an instinct. A feeling. The Force brought us together. Not alone. Good people will fight if we lead them.
People keep telling me they know me. No one does.
But I do.
Long have I waited. Now, you're coming together. Is your undoing.
Patrick Willems, how are you doing today? Thanks for joining me today.
Dave, I'm doing pretty well. Yeah, thanks for having me.
So we recently watched The Skywalker Legacy on Disney Plus, and you're the first person I thought of when I was watching this documentary because I have appreciated a lot of your videos about Star Wars, and I think you and I come from a very similar place when it comes to Star Wars, which is to say we really enjoyed many of the entries in the franchise and found Episode 8 in particular, The Last Jedi, to be quite intellectually stimulating with all the possibilities it brought up. And then we're really crushingly disappointed by Episode 9, and we're left in a weird place about how to relate to the fandom. Is that correct?
That is absolutely correct. I couldn't have said it better myself.
So I had heard that the Skywalker Legacy documentary was really great. And at the same time, I really didn't enjoy The Rise of Skywalker. So I didn't want to buy The Rise of Skywalker when it first came out, but I already subscribed to Disney Plus. And so I thought, let's wait until Skywalker is on Disney Plus, and then we can watch it there. And I wasn't sure if the documentary would accompany Episode 9 onto Disney Plus, but the day came when Rise of Skywalker appeared on Disney Plus, and then the documentary was there. So I was really psyched to finally see it. And I watched it, and I have to say, overall, I thought it was a wonderful celebration of the art of filmmaking. I mean, what did you think overall of this behind-the-scenes documentary?
Yeah, I would agree with that. I had an odd reaction to this documentary, mm-hmm. because I feel like I would have loved it if it was about a different movie. Because it is a wonderful celebration of the art of filmmaking, and especially all the different like crafts that go into it. Because like the best stuff in this documentary is the when it explores not the actors are the director or writers, but when it really gets into the process of like making the costumes and building the different creatures and shooting at these different locations and the incredible sets that they built, and really just the, you know, to for lack of a better term, this the movie magic that they created in the process of making this movie. It's there's some really breathtaking work, some of the most talented people in these fields in the world doing like top tier work, and it kept bumming me out because like seeing them talk so passionately about it and see how hard they were working and the amazing things they were doing, because to me it's all in service of something that I just really don't like. And it's like, I'm not saying it all went to waste, because you can still see it there and marvel at what they've done.
You can still appreciate the artistry, even though...
Exactly. Yeah. And it's just because I think this movie, and we've talked about this before, is just kind of fundamentally broken. I think from the ground up, like everything it's trying to do, like the story on a most basic level doesn't work. And it's I think it's a shame that... Okay, this is why I'm very conflicted. I don't know if I should say it's a shame, but it did kind of make me a little bit sad to see all this amazing work go towards something that in the end I just find so deeply disappointing.
Yeah, I think that it raises the importance. It elevates the importance of a script in terms of any filmmaking, right? Like, no matter how dazzling the visual effects are or how skilled the stunt work is, if the story is not there, if the script is not good, then the movie itself is not going to be great. Those other technical aspects can compensate for a great deal. But fundamentally, you need to feel emotional attachment to the characters and what they're going through. And if the script and the story don't establish that, then all the craftsmen in the world are not going to be able to overcome that necessarily. There are exceptions to that, but they're exceptions for a reason. But let's talk a little bit about some of the things that surprise us. Let's talk about the good before we dive into the more disappointing and the challenging, right? I think that there are many things in the Skywalker legacy that really it's not that it surprised me, because when you're watching a movie like Rise of Skywalker, on some level you know that a ton of work went into every single scene, every single shot. Mm-hmm. But there are things that you don't really fully understand the level of work, right? So I'll list just a few things that came up that I was really impressed by. One was, I think Eunice Huthart is her name. She's the stunt coordinator. She's kind of one of the main characters in the documentary.
She was great.
She's so good. And, there's a scene like early on in Rise of Skywalker when Rey leaps over a pit, you know, when she's doing
like
her training.
A chasm.
And, you get to see that shot filmed and it's like, wow, you remember how much preparation it takes to do something even that basic that in the movie lasts for maybe 3 seconds. You know, she does this jump and it's like, wow, they had to prep her and they had to wire her up and make sure she landed okay. And this woman, Eunice, was just like a complete delight throughout. You could tell she loved everything she was doing and she did a great job. A lot of the stunt work was awesome, right? That's one thing that really caught my attention. Another thing is, I would say the big festival that they had in the middle of the desert, you see all these people in the middle of a tent in the desert practicing the choreographed steps that someone had to come up with to do the dance at this festival. And it's just like, wow, this must have taken so much work for something that lasts like, I don't know, 30 seconds on screen, you know, like...
Yeah, I mean, let me just break down, like, the steps that went into creating this thing.
Yeah.
So they're shooting in, I think, the the desert in Jordan.
I think that's right, yes.
And so they have what seems like hundreds of extras who have all learned a choreographed alien, like, celebratory, like, traditional dance that someone created. And then each one of these people is outfitted in a full like head covering like alien like yes. prosthetic mask, but those prosthetic masks also have like remote controlled animatronic parts to them that move.
Yes.
So you also imagine like how hard it was to build every single one of these that everyone wears. And then they're also wearing these costumes that Michael Kaplan designed and made from fabrics that they had to like find like all over the world. I think he said a lot of the fabric came from Italy. And this is all just for a bunch of background aliens in one scene that don't even speak.
Yeah.
Even though they have like similar sized budgets, Marvel movies tend to be shot in like Atlanta parking lots with a lot of green screens, mm-hmm. and like the sets are largely CGI. And then you look at the Star Wars movie and they're constructing like entire towns, like fully. These like incredible sets.
Yeah.
They're building like alien civilizations for real, like halfway around the world. Like they're going to these lengths to like actually build physical things that pretty much no other movies are doing. It's really astounding.
Yeah, we'll get to this a little bit later, but I was watching the previous documentary, The Director and the Jedi, for Last Jedi, and the producer was commenting on the set for the Jedi tree that they built, right, in that movie. And he said, in a typical movie, we would build a set this elaborate and large and shoot on it for a month. For this movie, we're shooting on it for a day, you know, which is pretty remarkable. But even going back to the festival in Rise of Skywalker, in that scene, there is this is something that when I was watching the documentaries for making of documentaries for each of these movies, they're putting all this work into a creature or something where I watched it and I'm like, I don't even remember that thing being in the movie, you know? And they spend like hours iterating on this thing and then designing it in real life. And it's just incredible. And I'm not saying just because I don't remember that it didn't contribute something. I'm saying, like, it's incredible how much work goes into the smallest detail, right? And in the case of the festival, there was a scene in the documentary with these little baby aliens, like, doing, like, getting, like, a teacher school lesson or a puppet show or something.
Right.
They're getting a lesson of some kind. And in the in reality, on the set, they dug a trench to put puppeteers underneath so that they could puppet the tiny baby aliens for that shot must have been, I don't know, less than a minute, right? Less than a minute of the movie's runtime.
Mm-hmm.
And it is breathtaking. It's just breathtaking how much work went into it. So I just want to acknowledge that to start with before we get into why the movie wasn't very good.
I think that really gets into one of the like, the things that has always been special about Star Wars, which is the fact that it exists in a world where it feels like there's like infinite depth to it. Where, I mean, like the classic example is, you know, you have the cantina scene in the original movie, and obviously they like published a whole book called Tales from the Cantina with stories about every single alien in there. Because when you watch that scene, there's so much attention to detail where every extra is like designed enough that they seem like they could be their own character. And so you can kind of look into the background of every shot in a Star Wars movie. And there is, you know, there's like a unique character or creature that, that, you know, days was spent designing and creating, where there's the possibility that there is like a story about like, you know, in every corner of every frame. And, and that even in a bad Star Wars movie that they still maintain that.
Right. And it's really kind of a wonderful, sort of proof of the idea that demonstration of the idea that like, cinema is a unique art form, right? That, like, because set design and creature design can, like, actually inform story, like, it all creates a symbiotic relationship that's kind of unique to film, you know, in the sense that if it was an audio podcast, you're not necessarily going to have, oh, the creature design was so cool that now we can write a whole story. Like, Boba Fett was a helmet. Let's make a Disney Plus series off of him. You know, like, you wouldn't have that if it was, like, an audio podcast or a news article or, you know, whatever, like, a feature in a magazine. Like, it's just something unique to cinema that, like, because you have all these craftsmen working together, you can create something quite unique and have, like, different departments feeding off each other in a very exciting and good way.
Yeah.
So, another thing that came to mind also, like, in the at the Rebel base or the Resistance base, whatever you want to call it, there were, like, all these droids in the background. Then there was, like, little people in the droids just walking around in the background doing things. And I just was like, oh, my gosh, I didn't even realize that there were all these droids in the background or, like, little tiny touches in the background that just creatures that I never saw. There was a shot of the Millennium Falcon, like, whizzing into this planet, and there are these two little, like, furry creatures in the foreground, and you see the people, like, have to puppet them, and they're waiting for just the right weather conditions to shoot that scene where those creatures turn around to look at the Millennium Falcon flying past them.
Yeah, they designed, like, a species of creature for one establishing shot.
Yes. It's incredible. It's incredible.
It is. Yeah. Like, and consistently, like you look at the way that they developed Babu Frick, and obviously there are puppeteers in, like, full body like chroma
green
key
screen,
green screen suits puppeteering him, but then also they developed this way for the actress who voices him, who I am blanking on her name, but I know she was Moaning Myrtle in the second Harry Potter movie.
Mm-hmm.
But she actually is on set with her own remote control to, like, operate his face so that his mouth can match what she's saying. So she's actually, like, the actual actor is controlling the performance of this animatronic creature that's being puppet. I mean, they're basically, like, seems like four or five people on set at this one time to create this character who's, like, 7 inches tall.
Yeah.
And they're, like,
to be fair, one of the most memorable characters from the movie, but yeah.
I mean, the no joke, my favorite thing in this movie. But they're like, breaking new filmmaking ground and, like, innovating.
Yes.
Like constantly with this movie and developing new techniques. And it's so exciting to watch. And then what would keep happening every time one of these things would come up in the documentary, I'd be like, wow, that's so cool. And then I'd think, and then I'd remember the scene that it's for, and I'd go, oh, but it's for that scene where that stuff happens, and then I just get sad.
Well, one of the scenes that I thought was most, kind of captured the entire conflict I have with this whole documentary and this movie, is there is a scene where the conceptual artist, I don't know exactly what the roles were, but they're trying to figure out, in the movie Episode 9, there's a scene where, like, all the heroes come upon this ledge and they look over the ruins of the Death Star.
I knew you were going to talk about this, right?
And so somebody says, okay, well, JJ wants us to go and, like, look over the ruins of the Death Star. So we started figuring out what piece of the Death Star could be there. You know, it's like, could it be a trench? Could it be the dish? And they basically are like, they tried to do the trench, but it made no sense spatially. Like, the trench is too big. They couldn't fit like a trench into this body of water and have it make sense. Mm-hmm. So it's like, what about the dish? Just like, what if we put the dish there? And J.J. Abrams said something like, oh, it's too obvious for them to just find the dish. Like, it can't be just the dish. So it's like, okay, what if it's like a piece of a dish and, like, a piece of the hull around it? And then that was what they ended up going with. And the whole time they're doing this, you know, my reaction is, Do you realize that the Death Star completely exploded into like a million pieces at the end of episode 6? You know, that no one like took a step back and asked the question, hey, it like atomized into, it's just complete vapor at the end of episode 6. And I think that brings me to what I would assess as the two original sins of episode 9. And these are my thoughts on the original sins. I want to hear whether you agree with me or not, okay? Because I think every problem from episode 9 stems from these two decisions, right? Number one is, well, not every problem, but like most of the problems, the bulk of the problems. Number one is the decision to bring back Palpatine, right? Which there is this line, and I think it was episode 2 or 3 where, you know, Palpatine says, like, there's many ways of the powers can act. Some deemed unnatural.
It's in the Darth Plagueis scene at the opera in Revenge of the Sith. The dark side of the Force is a pathway to many abilities consider to be unnatural, which he repeats in this movie.
Correct. As an explanatory thing. And I think the writers of this movie like heard that line. And it sounded like it was a JJ thing, by the way, like based on the documentary, as far as I recall. It's like he heard that or someone heard that and thought, like, I want to bring that back. So intriguing to me. I've always wanted to pay that off, right? And so let's bring back Palpatine, even though they didn't explain it at all, and on a large level, it makes no sense. And then perhaps more importantly, it undoes a lot of the work that episode 8 did in terms of establishing Rey's lineage as coming from nowhere and how exciting that was and so on, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then original sin number 2, I hate to say it, is the decision to include Carrie Fisher in this movie, right? Which I understand it was for very like good reasons. They're very well intentioned. I know her daughter is in this movie. Like, it makes complete sense to me. Like, if I was involved in the decision making, I very likely would have made the same decision. But I think, yeah, you're hearing them talking about it, you know, and J.J. Abrams or Kathleen Kennedy, they're like, oh, we had to include her somehow. We just had to figure out a way to include her. And it's like, I understand all the work that went into, and it's actually very interesting, the work that went into filming it so that she could appear. But I just keep imagining an alternate movie where, like, opening credits, you know, she's passed away, like, General Organa has passed away, and then, like, it opens with, like, everyone mourning her, and then, like, you move on to a new story. Rather than trying to fit her in using footage that wasn't shot for that purpose. So those are kind of the two things that I realized, like, we're holding on to the past, right? We're holding on to what came before in a way that is very human, very logical. I don't like fault them for it, but I do think it led to a lot of problems with the story of this film. What do you think?
I mean, I totally agree. I'm going to repeat something that I've already said in a video that I made, but I think, this movie, watching it, really kind of revealed what I'd kind of been like afraid was the case with J.J. Abrams before. But this movie like confirmed it, which is that for the things that there are things that he's very, very good at.
Yeah.
But I think at the end of the day, he doesn't really have any like new or unique ideas. He's very like, he's good at, you know,
remixing,
dusting off
old ideas,
remixing, repackaging, putting like a fresh coat of paint on things, imitating things that he loves. And when you get to this movie, you know, the only real, and again, I'm just quoting myself from a video I made a couple months ago, but every time there was that he had to like make a choice, the answer he came up with was just use a thing that we've seen before.
Yeah.
And even right down to let's write like 20% of the movie around footage that we've already shot, and this is obviously the Carrie Fisher stuff, and this is I think is what frustrated me the most in this documentary, the part when they're talking about how they're talking about literally writing the script and how they looked at all the footage they had and they were writing lines or they were writing dialogue scenes around existing lines that she said in deleted scenes from The Force Awakens. I'm just thinking, this is such a bad way to write a story.
Yeah, yeah.
You are putting yourself in this tiny little box where, again, this is this is apparently the end of a 9-movie saga, and they are tying their hands like so tightly behind their back by saying, like, we have to use all of this. And there, because you look at the story decisions that come from that as well, the scenes, like the footage they were working from was footage where she had never met Rey, but now has to interact with her and have like emotional scenes with her.
Yeah.
And so that means that she has to be confined to one location, and that means that all of, like, the resistance has to be confined to one location. And I feel like every time the movie returns to that location, it just grinds to a screeching halt as you're just uncomfortable watching these scenes that you know are... That's like, it's technically impressive that they managed to put Carrie Fisher in these scenes,
right,
but it's very distracting and dramatically... doesn't work.
Yeah.
And the same thing with Palpatine, where there's one part, I think Abrams says it in the documentary, where he says, you know what, if you had asked me like halfway through episode 7, then I would say this was always where it was going to go. And I don't believe that for a second.
Mm-hmm.
There is nothing in the previous two movies that leads you to think like, oh, the villain who died 30 years ago is just going to show up at the end and say, I was behind it all and I'm still alive. It's just the Blofeld thing from Spectre all over again. You can't have a person mysteriously appear at the end and say, I did all of that other stuff.
Yeah.
And okay, here's where I want to delve a little bit deeper into, like, the behind the scenes of this movie and the narrative that this documentary presents.
Yes.
Because what, I'm not going to say too much about this because it's not, I've heard various things from like friends who know people at like Lucasfilm or whatever. I've heard stories about stuff that happened behind the scenes of this movie, and I'm not gonna like go dump all of that. But this was a messy production. Obviously, we know that it had a shorter like production timeline than they would have liked.
It had a different director at some point.
Yeah. It did, and this documentary presents a very smooth, positive, wonderful filmmaking experience when I'm fairly certain it was not that. And a thing that I have not been able to find any more information about, but I'm so curious about, is at what point in the process they made the Palpatine choice, because they spend maybe like 7 minutes in this whole 2-hour documentary on Palpatine.
Well, but what's interesting, okay, is, and this brings us to kind of comparing this with the director and the Jedi, which is the documentary for episode 8, The Last Jedi, featuring Rian Johnson. I watched that one to prepare for our conversation today, and it is pretty fascinating, the contrast between those two behind-the-scenes documentaries. Let me throw out a couple differences, right? One is that the Episode 9, Skywalker Legacy, I mean, first of all, Episode 9-1 refers back to, like, this is actually a really great part of it, is it refers back to original interviews with the cast from, like, the first trilogy, right? You see like young Mark Hamill, young Carrie Fisher, and then it often you see them interacting or responding to questions that are being asked of actors in the present day. And that's fascinating because it's like George Lucas has always wanted, you know, future editions of the movies to rhyme and echo each other. And you kind of hear like an echo in the past of like the actors that played these iconic characters before went through many of the same things, be it through training or grappling with fame or those kind of things. So that was a really interesting part of the Skywalker Legacy, the Episode 9 documentary. The Episode 8 documentary, The Director and the Jedi, really frames it as this is an untested director whose announcement was actually genuinely shocking. And it's easy to forget now that we're years past, like how much of a surprise it was when it first happened. And, you know, people were wondering, can he actually pull this off? He did. But you do get a sense of the magnitude of what episode 8 was compared to what he had done in the past. And that was a great part of the director in The Jedi. But another thing of the director in The Jedi is like very few interviews with actors. Compared to the Skywalker Legacy, right? The Skywalker Legacy is very shiny and it's like, oh, it was so fun to do the stunts and the blah, blah, blah. And episode 8, it's mostly Rian Johnson and Mark Hamill is the one who gets the most exposure. And when Mark Hamill is being interviewed, he's saying how much he hates Rian Johnson's decisions. Now, to be fair, it's actually genuinely moving, I thought, because Mark Hamill says... in the Director of the Jedi, you know, I think he says something like, I don't own this character, right? Like, the character belongs to other people. They just, like, rent it out to me every now and then, which is, like, I thought was such a great, humble attitude about being Luke Skywalker, you know? Mm-hmm. But anyway, I say all that to just kind of bring the contrast of, like, the Episode 8 documentary was very much like, you are wondering if any of this is actually going to work. And in episode 9, it's like, woo, we're having an amazing time. Like, everyone's having a blast. Episode 8, it's like, there's people who are, like, objecting to Rian Johnson's decisions. Like, the casino planet. There's a guy whose job it is to make costumes. And he says, this makes absolutely no sense. We've never seen, like, a gala in the Star Wars universe before. Like, and at the same time as you sympathize with this person who has apparently made many costumes for Star Wars before... I also was newly appreciative of episode 8 watching the Director of the Jedi, because you realize that, okay, the casino planet stuff, I thought it was kind of silly and superfluous, to be honest with you, but I appreciated that Rian Johnson was trying to like expand the aperture of the universe. He's trying to like show us things we have never seen before in that universe. Mm-hmm. And even though I could have done without the casino stuff, I appreciated that, like, he's showing us new worlds and new ideas in a way that maybe J.J. Abrams' movies did not. Anyway, that was a bit of a extended rambling there, but I was trying to agree with you that the Episode 9 documentary, Skywalker Legacy, is very like, this is great, everyone's happy, there's no problems.
Yeah, and this is kind of what, while I generally enjoyed watching it, this is kind of what bothers me about it, because so I think it's been established, or at least confirmed. I know in a recent tweet from his admittedly like private Twitter account, you know, Pablo Hidalgo from the Lucasfilm Story Group.
Yes.
He has said that the episode 8 story was locked in before Force Awakens was in theaters. Like it was like the only Star Wars movie that wrapped, I think, early. It was obviously a lot of the Star Wars movies in the Disney era have had difficult productions. The Last Jedi is the one that had a totally smooth one.
Right.
From start to finish, like, yeah. He wrote a script, the story was locked in, they made the movie, the production went smoothly, it finished on time, it was good, and apparently everyone at Lucasfilm loved the experience, loved working with Rian Johnson, and then you look at the fact that the documentary they made, and I think this speaks to the confidence they had, that they were able to get a bit more honest about, like, look, even though this was, you know, a smooth filmmaking process by, like, blockbuster standards, you know, there are still disagreements.
There's a whole sequence where the actors get really tired, you know? Right. It's just like, wow, it was an exhausting shoot. We had to shoot for months on end,
like,
right?
It's hard to make a movie,
yeah.
And there are a lot of people with different opinions and perspectives who all have to come together and hopefully in the end agree on something. And I think it's honestly one of the better, like, behind the scenes documentaries I've seen. And then you look at the Rise of Skywalker one, which is a movie that just based on, you know, Colin Trevorrow being fired and then Abrams being hired with like less prep time and all of that. And we just know, it is public knowledge that this was a harder production that was not as clean. And I know, you know, and people, other members of Lucasfilm Story Group, like Matt Martin, have said on Twitter that they didn't actually work on this movie when they were involved in pretty much all the others. And so this was a harder production, and you know that there are a lot of stories there, and this documentary doesn't get into any of them.
Now, to be fair, I do want to say, though, to be fair, that the documentary Skywalker Legacy does do a good job of explaining that making a movie is hard work. Like,
everyone's working hard on it, right?
Everyone's working really hard, but there was very little conflict.
Nothing seems to really go wrong.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's the thing. And this is, I'm, as much as I don't like this movie, I have been so fascinated by the behind-the-scenes story to it. And, Dave, have you actually read the Trevorrow screenplay,
Duel of the Fates? I haven't read the screenplay, but I've seen people have made, like, there's an animated video online that's very entertaining that's kind of an animated version of that screenplay.
It's a really interesting read.
Yeah.
I think it's better than the movie that they made.
Although who knows what that movie would have ended up being, you know,
Exactly. I mean, yeah. I think on a story level, it works better. And so, and I'm so curious about all of it. And, from down to like, why did Trevorrow get fired when they had a script that is a pretty solid continuation of what had come before? And then everything that happened with this movie, and like, what is the deal with, like, you know, with, like, when was the Palpatine decision made? I know there's been stuff talked about, like, people have so many theories about why they bring Kylo Ren's helmet back after it got destroyed.
Yeah.
And I've heard, again, these are just theories, but I've heard some people theorize that the scene where he tells Rey that she's a Palpatine, he has the helmet on for it. And I think that the sound designer mentioned in an interview that they were ADRing lines for that scene in Adam Driver's apartment in Brooklyn in like November. And some people have wondered, like, was the Rey Palpatine decision like one that happened like during production, like late in the game? And again, these are just, but the thing is, these are just theories, but I think because they've been so tight-lipped about the production of this movie, we can't help but question so many things and wonder about like what really went on.
It's interesting how some of the episode 8 decisions are presented in the new one, right? So I took some notes, and the Kylo Ren stuff is presented as like JJ wanted Kylo Ren to wear the helmet. But quote unquote, we had to address what happened in episode 8, which is that the helmet is completely destroyed, right? And that's just how it's presented. It's like, you know, JJ wanted it. We had to do it. We had to, you know, figure out a story way to bring it back. So there you go.
And then you look at the way they talk about it, and when they get into, I think, was it the Japanese tradition of like using gold to like to mend like pots that had broken, and so it would have these colored lines through it through the cracks, and I'm like, that's a really cool artful way to do it, but it's still executing a decision I don't understand in the first place.
Yeah, and the way that episode 9, and you've talked about this, like, they didn't yes and a lot of the decisions made in episode 8. Even, and at watching the two documentaries next to each other, even things that would have been relatively easy for them to yes and, they didn't do. You know, I'll give you an example. Like, the idea at the end of episode 8 is that Luke Skywalker's final act of heroism, going up against Kylo and then vanishing, right? That the idea behind that was that it would inspire the rest of the galaxy to like take up arms and so on. Completely unacknowledged in episode 9. And even when such a thing was like a thing to inspire everyone was needed, you know, to bring everyone back at the end. Like they could have easily figured out a way to make that work, but it felt like, I wouldn't say they went out of their way to ignore episode 8, but they like... Actually, that's not true, because with the Kylo Ren helmet, they kind of went out of their way to ignore episode 8. They had to actually design the new helmet. But it does feel like a lot of the decisions weren't really respected from episode 8, because he wanted the pendulum to swing back the other way. Obviously, the Palpatine thing being the greatest one. One other thing that I thought was interesting contrast is just that episode 8 focused much more on the story of the movie, as opposed to the episode 8 documentary, The Director of the Jedi, focused much more on the story. And Rian Johnson in the documentary is talking about what does each character want. He talks about like how he writes down what every character at the end of Force Awakens wants, and like what do they want, what is the hardest path for them to get what they want, and how do I put them on the hardest path. And you can disagree with the execution, for sure. Many people do. You know, the whole Poe thing and realizing that leadership is more important than heroism. Great message, especially today in America. Did the movie do a good job of elucidating that message? You can have your own opinion on that. But I appreciate that it was like trying to go for something really bold in that. Like where Star Wars in the past has prized heroism. You know, it's been like heroism is the thing that is going to get us out of this thing. And they're like, no. After heroism comes like being responsible, taking in the whole picture. Whether the movie did a good job, again, you can have your opinion, but I appreciate it. And then... of course, the Rey thing and finding out that her parents are nobodies, like all these things were like really challenging decisions to make. And it made me reappreciate what Rian Johnson's thinking was behind it. Literally, none of that kind of stuff is discussed in the Skywalker Legacy. It's all about like, oh my gosh, like look how cool this is. Look how cool Sheev Palpatine looks, you know, in the getup that with the fingernails and everything like that. And you know, I think that's obvious in the movies as well, in my opinion. So
I think it gets back to that Abrams thing where, especially because he has to end a story here, and the only answers that he has, his whole like. I guess his like, you know, modus operandi for the whole thing is just put in all the Star Wars stuff that we've liked before, whether it's, whether it's once again, having the third movie in a trilogy end with, Palpatine in a throne room while the rebel fleet is getting like, is losing a battle outside the window. Whether all of these things, whether it's like, let's go back to the Death Star. Let's, despite the fact that we had that perfect setup for Luke to inspire the galaxy to come and help, let's ignore that, because wouldn't it be cool if Lando showed up and he was the one who rounded up everybody?
Right.
This is what disappoints me so much about this movie, because like I don't want to say I was optimistic, but my hope was that Abrams, who is this guy who has avoided ending stories for his whole career and has talked about how he has struggled with endings. And I was thinking like, okay, now he has no choice. And this is the time to actually like deal with his problem and figure out how to end something in a satisfying way that will mean something. And I feel like he just didn't even think it through. He just and to be fair,
we don't know, right? I mean, it's very likely he thought it through, but like maybe time constraints prevented him from thinking it through as much as he would have liked, you know?
Maybe
I'd be very careful about his motivations, right? If that makes any sense.
The thing is, I think he's trying to please everybody.
Yeah.
And which I get it. That's not a harmful thing. I'm not accusing him of being evil or anything like that.
Well, another telling line from Episode 9 documentary, Skywalker Legacy, is when Luke Skywalker comes back, they say like, "Oh, it was so great for Mark Hamill to be able to play the Luke Skywalker of old." I think that's what is, and it was great for everyone to see him that way. Now, that is the one complaint against Episode 9 that actually doesn't make sense to me. Like, I've thought about it, and it's like, okay, it makes sense, because at the end of Episode 8, Skywalker's had this whole journey, and now he's a different person. You know, he's passed on to the afterlife, and he's like theoretically more back to the Skywalker of old. But it also felt like, you know, that's the thing they want to get back to. They want to give people that Star Wars feeling, which is something that you've talked about in the past, right? And episode 8, I think you can convincingly argue that episode 8 did not give people that Star Wars feeling, which is things that they recognize, lightsaber duels and huge things blowing up real good and things of that nature, right?
Yeah. I mean, the thing is, we're not here to relitigate The Last Jedi once again, but I feel like it that's a movie that still does have all of those surface elements that we love about Star Wars, but then it also just makes us think a little bit deeper about them. But you get back to like the Luke thing in Rise of Skywalker, and they talk a bunch about this, how, you know, the part where he lifts the X-wing up,
yeah,
and you know, you've got them saying, and you know, they've literally got a full physical practical X-wing there being lifted up. It's like
it looks.
Not,
it looks incredible.
Does. It's not CGI, which I just assumed that it was in the movie. And they're talking about like how wouldn't it be this amazing payoff, you know, from Empire when he couldn't lift the X-wing up. And I've got to say, I have not been wondering my whole life, did Luke ever learn how to lift that X-wing up? It feels to me that they're literally just repeating a moment that we liked in an earlier movie, hoping it'll make us feel the same way.
I think there's something about these behind-the-scenes documentaries in general, not just for these movies, but just in general, that kind of fetishize the past, right? Mm-hmm. That elevate the idea of slavish imitation. And as an example of that, in the opening scenes of episode 9, Rey is training, right? You see Rey training in the forest, and it looks really incredible. It's like a great sequence. And then she has that little like orb that they had in Star Wars episode 4, the little orb that like floats around and it like shoots you and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
That orb in the original trilogy was an orb that like theoretically they improvised that. Right, like it's you use it for like blaster training theoretically is what I understand, and it's like, oh, we found this old thing lying around and we're using it for lightsaber training. Like, oh, what a creative way we used a janky ass thing to like do lightsaber training. So, A, it doesn't make sense that then you see the little kids doing it in the prequels, right? Because like, why would they have had the little orbs if that was an improvised solution? And B, you know, in the Rise of Skywalker documentary, Skywalker Legacy, you see them being like, this mold was based off of the original orb mold from episode 4. And it's like, there's a lot of imitation of the past without thinking through, like, wait, does it even make sense that we'd have the same orb? Like, why would we have the same orb? Now, mm-hmm. to be fair, this is also in the Direction of the Jedi, where they use the original Yoda mold to do like the Yoda puppet in that movie. So it's not like, right. I'm just saying it's just a Skywalker legacy that like adheres to this. But like, I remember when Watchmen came out, I was really immersed in that scene, the movie Watchmen, Zack Snyder. And I was really like, went to Comic-Con and talked with some of the on-set photographer and, you know, and watching the documentary, so it's like, oh yes, everything tries to like, we tried to imitate Dave Gibbons' original comics as much as possible. And I think like, I appreciate the artistry and craftsmanship and the respect that represents, but it only is good insofar as it serves a story, I think, in general. And I wish these behind-the-scenes documentaries would like get away from like, hey, we did the thing that you've already seen before extremely skillfully, because it's not as important as making a good story, right? Or reinventing the ideas for a new audience or what have you. So anyway, I will say, though, that this adherence to the past really led to a heartwarming moment for me in the documentary when John Williams appears.
Yeah. Right?
This is incredible. There's a scene in Rise of Skywalker where John Williams is in it for like a second. He's like a machine shop person. And he has all these like trinkets and knickknacks around him. And you learn in the documentary that John Williams has been nominated for 51 Oscars at the time of the shooting, I think, of Rise of Skywalker. And every object represented a movie he had been Oscar nominated for, but built in the Skywalker universe, right?
Yeah.
Like, or the Star Wars universe. Like, there was like a Saving Private Ryan thing and a, you know, a Jurassic Park thing and a Hook thing. And it's just like, why?
They had some weird ones in there too. Because again, they went, this is a thing that I found very interesting about this scene. And I do have to say, I think the tribute to John Williams is really wonderful.
So heartwarming.
I think
the
attention to detail by like the craftspeople in building these props is it is astounding.
Yeah.
It is absolutely like breathtaking work. I think it's interesting that they, for this theme, they picked the criteria of Oscar nominations. not like, you know, just his most beloved movies, but because they've got one in there for The Book Thief. A film that basically doesn't exist. That I forgot he did the score for it because this movie came out like 2 years ago, and it's also one that I've never heard anyone talk about. And so I just found that really interesting. It's like, so, you know, you like, no one would have like really needed a book thief, like a commemorative object. Like, why pick Oscar nominations?
You just pissed off all the book thief fans out there, Patrick.
I don't take it back. I stand by my words. And look, I haven't seen The Book Thief.
Yeah.
I could read too much into this and get into you know, Abrams valuing the surface level like glitz of Oscar nominations, and deciding to focus on that. I think that's going a little bit too far. But I just found that interesting that was like the criteria they picked.
Mm. So a couple of the things I just want to mention real quick. Make sure we do mention them. There are also behind the scenes documentaries for other Star Wars movies, right? There was a Force Awakens one that was like, I felt was like a pretty fancy, you know, it's a very standard behind the scenes documentary. I thought there was very little that was like remarkable about it. It's really fascinating, but it's like, Director of the Jedi and Skywalker Legacy, I think both had interesting angles that one did not have. Right.
Can I just add one thing to that?
Yeah.
And I find this really interesting that the Force Awakens documentary didn't, you know, have, like a lot of interest enough to get into, because that's also a movie that, you know, by most reports had also kind of a tricky production where,
yeah.
You know, obviously Abrams has talked about how, Harrison Ford breaking his leg and the shutdown of production gave them time to like rework some stuff and improve the movie. But also apparently they were like reshooting scenes like in the Bad Robot offices down to like the very like last month before the movie was released and like still changing story details.
Yeah.
Like I believe the, I could be mistaken, but I'm like fairly certain about this. Like the scene where Rey finds the lightsaber and talks to Maz Kanata, mm-hmm. in like the basement of her place, I believe was reshot in the Bad Robot offices, and that was like a very late change. But the documentary doesn't really get into that stuff.
Agreed. So it is kind of, it is a weird coincidence that the J.J. Abrams ones present a very, like, this is going great, when in fact, those were arguably the most troubled ones. And then the Episode 8 one presents, like, a very, like, in-conflict one, conflict production, when in fact, like, that was arguably the smoothest one. But probably the gold standard for all Star Wars documentaries has got to be the Phantom Menace one. I think it's called The Beginning, Making Episode 1.
Yeah, I mean, that's the one famously where you've got the part where, like, George Lucas watches the movie and
yeah,
he's like,
and it's like, this
I think
working.
We went a little too far.
Yeah, this isn't working. Yeah, and it's It is the gold standard of like showing you everything that happened, including the very, very bad parts. But at the same time, you also get like the excitement, you know, like Ewan McGregor is cast and like they cast the kid, Jake Lloyd, and like it's all exciting. And I love documentaries like that, you know, that capture the good and the bad. And I think that makes them better works of art in their own right. I'll just say one last thing about this, and then I'll go to you to see if you have any other closing comments. But watching the director and the Jedi, I did reflect on, you know, the movie begins right after the events of Episode 7. And Rian Johnson says, like, you know, I always wanted to see what happened in the moment right after Rey presents that lightsaber. And I guess, you know, when Rian describes it, it's very obvious. He says, Luke is not going to fire up this lightsaber and say, all right, let's go, because there's a reason he has sequestered himself in the middle of nowhere in the first place. And Mark Hamill really objected to that idea. And to be fair, like, I don't want to misrepresent, like, he came around to Rian's position and like it ended up seeming like a very respectful relationship. But he really disagreed with the idea that Luke would be this like cantankerous old hermit that is depicted in Episode 8. But it did make me feel like, what is it exactly that people wanted, Patrick? You know, because it seemed like they wanted Luke to be his old self. But yeah, he was on an island all by himself. So like, you got to explain why he was there and like respect that fact, which is a fact that J.J. Abrams presumably was involved in setting the table for. Right.
And not just that, but if you look at the parts of George Lucas's original plans that have leaked out and like the concept artwork from when he was working on his own sequel trilogy, you know, as this has been talked about a lot before, but Luke had like had become a recluse, was off on his own, basically like having isolated himself after some sort of failure, and was described as a Colonel Kurtz type. And so that's, I mean, this has been debated intensely for 2.5 years now.
Right.
But all the people who complain that, you know, Rian Johnson ruined Luke Skywalker and had him act out of character, and they wish George Lucas, who made the much maligned prequels, and he was attacked for them for years. They apparently wished that he would come back and make these movies. That was George Lucas's original plan for the character, was basically the exact same thing. J.J. Abrams set that up in Episode 7, and he was just working with the setup that he had handed.
Right.
And I don't understand what the other option would be.
Yeah. I guess it could be an option where he's, I literally don't know. Like, cause he's on an island all by himself. Like, he put himself there. Right. So there had to be some reason he put himself there. Anyway,
I think this gets back to, do you remember that? I mean, this was maybe like a year and a half ago. There was this tweet that went around, that got dunked on deservedly, I think, a lot, which was some person had photoshopped like old Luke, Han, Leia, and Chewie together, like with lightsabers and blasters. And they said, like, see Lucasfilm, this is what we really wanted. And did you ever see that?
I've probably seen some version of that, yeah.
Yeah, and basically the picture kind of represents the sort of easy, lazy fan service that I don't think would have made for good movies, but I do honestly think it's what a portion of the fan base did want. Not a movie that was that, like, you know, naturally carried on the story that was established in the original trilogy and actually, like, you know, moved Star Wars forward, but basically like a victory lap and kind of reward for being a Star Wars fan, which is just
right. All
your favorite characters being cool, kicking ass together, revisiting all the old stuff you've seen before.
Yeah.
And I think the kind of the core problem with Episode 9 is that it is the movie that kind of gives into that more than the others did. And I will always be bummed out about that.
Indeed. Well, I am glad I watched this documentary. it did help me to process some of my feelings about episode 9. You know, it did help me to appreciate the work that went into it. And even if it's a movie that you don't like, which is the case for me, you just know that any Star Wars requires a ton of work that I'm glad like the people who worked on it can be honored in this way. So any closing thoughts on the Skywalker legacy or the Skywalker legacy?
Well phrased, David.
If you know what I'm saying.
Yeah. I'm going to echo your thoughts. For all the you know, mixed feelings that watching this documentary gave me, I'm glad I watched it because, I think basically everyone other than, oh my God, this is going to sound so mean. I think pretty much everyone other than those who wrote the movie did pretty incredible work.
Yeah.
And I'm glad that this documentary really like shows you in detail the astounding just artistry that went into like every frame of this film. It's
such an act of trust that these people have, you know, it's like, I'm going to devote 6 weeks of my life to building this creature or this set or this prop, that you just have to trust that, hey, it's going to be used well. I mean, for many of these people, it's like a day job, you know, but there's other people who are like really invested in the storyline and the legacy of this emotionally. And
yeah.
You get a sense of like, it's like a huge responsibility on the director, I think.
It is.
To honor all that. So
one thing I did find very interesting, just like a little practical thing, was so you know those sort of like space horses that they ride?
Yeah.
For instance, I didn't realize that those were real horses covered in fake fur with just CGI'd heads in the finished movie. Although I do have to say, I still find it kind of weird that they introduced space horses when they introduced different space horses in episode 8. again, this movie wants us to pretend that didn't exist. One thing that I actually want to mention, because it connects to something that I watched recently. There was a really good video. I don't know if you ever watched the YouTube channel Sideways.
Mm-mm.
They analyze film music a lot, and they've got some good videos on there. But there was this half-hour-long video released within the past couple weeks or so called, I think it's like, Why the Rise of Skywalker Music Felt Empty. And because I did have the thought when I watched the movie, I was like, look, John Williams always kills it. And it's not that he's doing a bad job in this, but I feel like this is the least memorable Star Wars score, and there are like basically no new themes.
Mm.
And this video gets into, like, it really, like, breaks it down in great detail about how the kind of the problem with it is that what the movie constantly does is it uses themes and leitmotifs associated with specific things, but it uses them for completely different things, not the things that they're meant to represent. And so, like it plays Yoda's theme when Luke lifts the X-Wing up.
Right.
And Yoda isn't in that scene. It's just because it's...
But Yoda lifted the X-Wing in Empire Strikes Back. So.
Right, exactly. Or it'll use the Force theme, which is always used when it's like someone connects to or uses the Force, when like Finn and Jonna are riding the horses into battle. And it basically uses all... And what it kind of gets into and presents some pretty good evidence for is that it seems like John Williams actually wrote a lot of other music that wasn't used in the movie, and that it was a lot of like post-production work by like other music editors it looks like this might not have been his original plan for the score, and that the score was like reworked and re-edited in post-production to basically just kind of use a lot of memorable themes that we're familiar with, but that are devoid of the meaning that they're supposed to have.
Interesting. Interesting. Okay.
It's a good watch, I've got to say.
I'll link to it. But yeah. So overall, I think like this helps me to put a capper on my Star Wars Skywalker Legacy experience. And you know, I think we can leave it there, Patrick. Anything else?
Yes, if anyone was actually involved in the production and would like to tell us stories about what really happened, you can reach out to me on Twitter at Patrick H. Willems. My DMs are open.
All right. Well, Patrick H. Willems makes YouTube videos, video essays, and other great assorted things over on his channel, Patrick H. Willems. And also, he and I do commentaries on his second channel, Patrick H. Willems Presents. I would recommend you check those out as well and follow him on Twitter. Patrick, thanks so much for joining me today.
David, always a pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.